just to make a point.
Must have met our goal. Hey,
we are on the air, and I don't know how to turn off this music.
That's good.
Let's just listen to the Everly Brothers for a minute. All right. Welcome, Fairbanks. This is Craig Compo and the Laundry House Gang. I'm filling in for Dave Prus. So bear with me. I think we're actually going to try and use the phone bank system, so we may or may not make that successful. I've got Mike Tinker, Wayne Heimer, and Al Barrett here from the Laundry House Gang. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning.
All right. So, Mr. Tinker, you're usually in charge of the agenda. I know we've got a few things. Oh, let me get a little housekeeping out of the way, first of all, here. I got to clean this desk. Dave always leaves the desk really messy. He's got all these brochures here. What is this? Hang on. Oh, living with ED in your 60s. Okay.
That's why the city sent him the mayor training.
Headlights remedies for bald men. Okay, let me just get rid of this paperwork here, clean the desk off, and we'll get started here. Sorry, Dave. I always have to do that.
You just hope he's got his computer on wherever he is so he's listening. Yeah, that's all.
So what's on the agenda, Mike?
Well, I think for a little bit we need to talk about the bus. The Out of Into the Wild bus is reaching new fame. And I had a conversation with it. I actually texted the new president of the Board of Regents for the university the other day to see what he thought about this wonderful project.
So what's new with the bus?
Well, the bus is the recipient.
What bus are we talking about?
The dead guy bus, as Coke Wallace always calls it.
The
dead guy bus.
Yeah, the one that was residing in there is residing at the university now to wait for its restoration. And I don't think anybody in the public really knows what the restoration plan is, but the idea is to set it up so people can go take a look at it and associate with it. However, the news is out that the university's museum has received a $500,000 grant to restore the bus. And the bus probably cost $35,000, $36,000 originally.
This is George Soros money? Or
what? Yeah, well, you got me. This is in the news, and I thought...
State-funded?
No. I don't believe it. It's a grant. It's a grant fund, probably.
That kind of money, they could restore the residence.
That's what I would think. So, you know, if somebody knows about that, they could call in. I just caught the headline of that thing. But the amount staggered me because I would think if I was the kind of outdoor person that wanted to kind of take a look at what he did and they had it at the university somewhere, I would want to see that bus where I could maybe look at it, walk through it. You know, they do sometimes where they'll put like plexiglass on one side and you can walk on the other side, something like that, so I could see what happened. But I just can't imagine how much restoration needs to happen before the public could view it and realize that that was the vehicle that McCandless was in there.
I think they're just going to build a whole new building around it.
Yeah, and that'll be funded by the state. So it's, $500,000 feed a lot of hungry people, wouldn't it?
That's what I thought. Among the programs the museum has, it's hard to believe that, now keep in mind that money like that is grant specific. So somebody made an application for a grant for that project and got that grant. So it's not the kind of thing where they can take it
Do you know where the grant came from?
No, I didn't. It wasn't in the first paragraph of the news article. But I just think, that kind of thing, just like you said, Craig, is maybe, even though it's earmarked for something like that, it looks like gross overkill. And hopefully that there's a strategy for that. And maybe you got the right idea. Maybe there's some type of positioning that'll have a roof over it or, something so people can view it year-round and some way to eat up, this money.
Yeah. Well, that's just amazing where money can get spent. But, if it was privately funded, I wouldn't really have a problem with it. Somehow I think each one of us are going to be paying some of it at some point for maintenance or eventually hundreds from years from now when it's sunk down into the ground, it won't be able to build a highway near it because there's an archaeological dig going on there. Anyway, what else is on the agenda?
Well, this last week we had a shift in the 40-mile caribou hunt that's been going on, and even though we had over 100 quota left, they decided to shut down the road accessible areas, which makes it pretty hard for anybody to really go chase one. There are caribou in zones 2 and 3, which are the ones that are the isolated zone out in the in the headwaters of the Chenasalsha rivers, requiring quite a snow machine trip to get at them. There are some in zone 2 over off the Taylor Highway, which is also a 50-mile snow machine trip one way to get into where they are. No highway vehicles, which is not the end of the world from my estimation. They're trying to be very conservative this year. But at the same time, on all federal lands in the area, the Fed has, instead of realizing there's some conservation need here, not only reiterated that their federal lands are open for the federally qualified hunters for until March 31st, but also that the caribou limit will now be 2 for them instead of 1. And so it seems to me that this
way
is
to manage.
Yeah, this is the way we run around and shoot.
Kind of hard for me to keep track of what goes on.
Yeah.
Living in the bubble where I do, but the last time I poked my head out, there were too many caribou for the grub out there.
Yeah.
And the idea was to make fewer caribou so there'd be enough grub to go around and things would thrive. Did we get over that in just a year?
Yeah, we got 2 years. We got over it in 2 years, and then we, because we got new pictures, we got a new population estimate, which is all okay. The issue for me is that now we're going to take our theoretically more isolated folks that have trouble getting to the caribou anyway, and they're going to be able to go, run out there and shoot too. Fortunately, there's only a couple thousand people that are in that category that are qualified for that. But it seems to me, just like you're saying, Wayne, that if we're going to take the population down and take it right to the harvest quota, the appropriate thing would have been just leave it open. And my thinking on that really has nothing to do with wanting for me to get a caribou instead of somebody else, all that. But we manage for opportunity to harvest. We don't have a dull sheep for everybody. And we don't have a caribou or a moose for everybody. And we don't manage them that way. However, when you manage opportunity, on the federal side, these guys got an early start at this hunt, hunted an entire fall season, took a month off, came back October 27th, and now going to go to March. And it seems to me that that's kind of what we're trying to do. They talk about this food security, food sovereignty stuff. It's kind of like we got to have a caribou in every pot rather than enough time out there for people to hunt caribou.
I'd just like to make a comment on Wayne's asking this question on, we were last year bringing the population down because of the habitat couldn't support the caribou. They were unhealthy. And I still tend to believe that's true. We haven't gotten our new indicators to see if the caribou are healthier than they were a year or two ago. And so it's not about a population, it's about the health of the caribou.
Yeah, we're going to continue this discussion with the Laundry House Gang after we pay a few bills from some great local companies like Compos and some others. We'll be right back after these brief messages. Stick around, and you can even call 458-8255-907.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Small businesses, they're our family, they're our friends. So let's help them shine bright in the Golden Heart by shopping local this holiday season. Wishing you and yours a wonderful Christmas and a safe new year from all of us at Usabelli Coal Mine.
Hi, this is John.
And this is Michelle.
From Pearson Auto.
From our family to yours, we want to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Thank you for all your support throughout the years, and may God bless your families throughout the holidays.
From all of us at Pearson Auto in North Hole and West Fairbanks.
The Woodway is your interior Alaska steel outdoor power equipment dealer. In Alaska, your outdoor power equipment has to meet the demands of Alaskan conditions. It isn't just a benefit, it's essential. Steel products are engineered for a lifetime of superb service. Their chainsaw performance is legendary. As always, the Woodway's trained staff of technicians will provide all the service you need. See the full line of steel outdoor power equipment at the Woodway today. Live life the Alaskan way. The right way. The Woodway.
Spend your Saturdays with KFAR Radio for local programs. Starting with Alaska Realty Today from Next Home Arctic Sun Realty at 11 a.m. The Buzz at 11:30. Brought to you by the Tanana Herb Company. And then Health Talk with Dr. Scott Looper from White Spruce Medical at noon. Followed by the Combos Outdoor Show at 12:30. And later, it's Fairbanks Foodies at 5:30 p.m. All shows can be found on the KFAR website in the archives section. Weekends just got local with KFAR Radio.
Weather brought to you by the Eye Clinic of Fairbanks. Your eyes connect you to your world. Care for them with the Eye Clinic of Fairbanks, your eye health professionals on Mini Street.
KFAR Weather.
A winter weather advisory begins at 1 a.m. early tomorrow morning and continues until 9 p.m. Thursday night. Chance for snow today, otherwise cloudy. Highs around 19, winds out of the northeast, around 5 miles per hour. Overcast skies tonight, snow likely, 9 above. 2 to 4 inches of snow tonight through Thursday night. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
All right, gentlemen, we're back with the Laundry House Gang, filling in for Dave Pruz. I'm Craig Coppo, and we're with Mike Tinker, Wayne Heimer, and Al Barrett. We've been talking 40-mile caribou.
It looks we can kind of wrap up 40-mile. It's, you know, it's interesting because it's been a long time getting a good huntable population out. And now all of a sudden we get a real, you know, after a couple of years of lowering the population, as Al said, to match habitat or try to improve and balance there, we get into a numbers game of where we have a low quota and we've got to stop early because, heaven forbid, we don't want to get below the number that's set totally arbitrarily because we don't have any clue whether we're getting to the habitat level or not. Right. But the other thing I'd like to say is there's kind of a few interesting things that have happened. This year, for the first time in a few, a significant number of the caribou are speaking Canadian. We've had discussions about building the wall, so they can't do that. But
Are any of the bulls identifying as cows? Or?
Yeah, well, that's another issue, of course. So we haven't really got into that yet because the surveys aren't in. But the other thing that's interesting this year is a lot of people don't realize that they think of the Nelchina caribou herd as being out in the middle of Unit 13, like in 13B, which is kind of central there. And they certainly come through there. They wander through in the spring, summer, they calve over on the west side, and then they come across. But they run clear across 13 into 12 and then into 20. And last week, Fish and Game was aware that several radio callers from the 40-mile, I mean from the Nelchina herd, were way north of where they usually go along the Taylor Highway. They were clear up around mile 80, 90. And usually they get up in the Mount Fairplay to Mosquito Fork area, and then they kind of drop off. And if you find a caribou north of that, it's a 40-mile caribou. But for some reason, they're mixing with their buddies. And in those populations, they go over there for their winter feed and whatnot. The Nelchina, again, has a very big question mark on its population. They did not get a photo census, only caribou herd in Alaska that didn't this last year. But they didn't get a photo census. They came with a super conservative harvest quota there, and so the hunters that normally hunt in and depend on the Nelchina herd had a really tough time getting them this year, too. So, you know, we've got some things we need to...
As the resident historian slash geezer among us, I just know a couple things about caribou. One is that, you know, way back when caribou research first began, there was a fellow named Ron Skoog, who eventually became commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game, but he did his graduate work on caribou. And he's the guy that named them by the herd, and he named them by the herd where they calved. Mm-hmm. And the basic assumption is that if they calve in the Nelchina, they will always calve in the Nelchina. And in those days, of course, Mr. Skoog, Dr. Skoog, didn't know whether they ran up and down to the 40-mile or whatever. So we just call it the Nelchina, and the implicit assumption is that they're always going to be there and they're going to live there. Well, caribou apparently don't do that. And we've got huge confusion now and some management challenges because of what we didn't know when we made the assumption that caribou stay home.
Yeah, Well, there were studies done, habitat studies done on the west side of 13 that had, not by Scoob, but by his subsequent students and whatnot, but they came up and discovered that there wasn't enough winter habitat, you know, for them over there. They really were nervous about how they were going to make it. And even at that time, they were going 200 miles away for the winter, so it really didn't matter much.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, we have a phone call. We're going to try and take it here. Let's see if this works. Okay, you're on Problem Corner, and your name is?
Hey, this is Charles. I got some trivia on that bus.
Oh, good. We love it. Go. Bring it on. I love trivia.
The original bus in the film, anyway, was taken from Salcha by truck to Talkeetna, and that's where they filmed the movie. wasn't filmed at that location. It disappeared and didn't get returned to the owner in Salcha. And so there's a better bus out there, maybe.
Build bus better.
Right? I don't know.
Build
the bus better.
Yeah, I have a little. Thanks, caller. I appreciate that. I have a little trivia, too, on that. So they contacted me when they were filming that. They wanted a boat to run up the creek there to get to where they were going to do some of their filming. And I not a Sean Penn fan, I refused. I said, no, I'm not going to do it. I had a buddy, Floyd Brooks, I think it was, here in town, who had a boat. And because they asked me, well, who would do it? I said, I'll give you a name of a couple guys with boats. And, of course, he did it for the money. He went down there. But another quick side note, I remember they hired the whole town of Keeley and Cantwell, basically. They hired all these people to stand around and make coffee. The film crew was down there. Coke Wallace was down there when they brought their wolves from the San Diego Zoo. And it was cold out. And when they unloaded these wolves, Coke just started laughing. And Penn came over to him, Sean Penn, and said, I see you're laughing. What's funny? He goes, those are Samoyeds. Those are wolves. Wolves don't have tails that curl up like that. And he just made fun of them, you know, the whole time. So, but you know Coke would. So.
Anyway. Well, you did that to me one time.
I did?
Yeah, somebody came up here to make a film about gold mining. Oh, they wanted you to boat them where they wanted to be, and you said, I'm going moose hunting, try Heimer.
Yeah.
And that was another story.
Yeah, moose hunting takes priority over everything. But, anyway, so we are going to be, let's see, we got a few minutes, but I wanted to maybe shift from caribou to sheep a little bit since we have...
Excellent.
A author here in the room who just wrote a new book about doll sheep management, Wayne Heimer, and these books will be for sale. There's, you know, obviously probably nobody on the planet knows more about doll sheep than Wayne. Wayne, tell us a little bit about what's in the book and where they can get one and all that good stuff.
Well, what's in it is it's a history of doll sheep management, and I claim from the Ice Age to the present. And it's a fairly small book, considering the scope of the material. But
only weighs about a half a pound.
Yeah, and there are no pictures in it, so it's it's inexpensive.
Lets me out.
And I don't know what it's going to cost right now. I wrote the book for decision makers, really, for the Board of Game and leaders in the Department of Fish and Game, because doll sheep aren't thriving right now. They've had some bad winters over a protracted period of time. Could be the beginning of something serious and long-term, or it might just be what happens in the weather. But everybody that cares about doll sheep wants to fix it because we're concerned about hunting. And the reason we harvest doll sheep the way and manage them the way we do is because over the years, we've discovered a couple of things about their biology. And that work was done by my friends, and I was there as well, a long, long time ago, and nobody remembers how we got to where we are now. And, some of the latter-day biologists have said the reason we shoot full curls is because, and they make up stuff that seems reasonable to them. Turns out I'm the last guy still alive that was involved in that and is active in Alaska. And I thought maybe it's time I wrote the story down so that it'd be on the record someplace. So I wrote it up, and it's self-published, and I really published it or wrote it for decision makers and sheep hunters. Sheep hunters are always crazed to know about anything that they can find out about sheep. And, the department and the Board of Game, I thought, could use a history that would be available to them. So that's why I wrote it. The second printing The first printing was 22 copies. The second printing will be is supposed to be in transit and should be here soon, and I may
time
have some
Christmas?
Of those available. In time for Christmas.
There you go.
I ordered a whole whopping 100 copies because, unlike Pete Buist, I don't need them to weight down the back of my truck. I got greater blades for that.
So if somebody wants to get a book for themselves or for somebody in their family that's into sheep hunting or just into the history of sheep, how would they buy the book?
They would go to wainheimer.com.
Spell it.
And there's a tab there that my son put up for me just last week called Store. And I think through that, you can, I think the asking price is going to be like $15.
Okay.
Unlike Compos, I am in business to eke out a modest break-even point. And I think
$150, if that were the case.
I think they will be able to get in touch with me, and I can mail them a book. And I think the asking price is going to be $15.
So wainheimer.com, H-I-E-M-E-R.
H-E-I-M-E-R.
A-C, I got it backwards. I thought it was I before E, except after Wayne.
Except in Germanic.
Okay. All right.
So it's, wainheimer.com, and I think we can begin to hook you up with that fairly soon.
Good.
It's an example of tracking the history of how we come to the decisions and regulations that we have out there today. And it's been done for almost all of our big game species and some of our others around, and yet this is a concise description of where somebody can sit down and read it and say, okay, this is what happened.
Thank you, Mike. I don't usually get that description.
Well, the problem is the problem for a lot of these people is that we don't do a good job communicating where the decisions came from. And I mean we as a state when new people come in and whatnot. And so you get even, I would suspect, probably we have two or three generations of area biologists that don't have a clue.
You're right.
Where this came from. And to me, that's an omission. That in order to administer the regulations of the day and make recommendations for new ones as they come along, you should have the history.
Yeah. Well, we're lucky to have you, Wayne, because it is really a nice history that you've spent your entire life, around. And so people that are really into sheep hunting or just want to learn more should probably.
I hope there's enough fun in there to make it readable.
Yeah, well, there usually is. Your reading is usually pretty entertaining. You know, Wayne does a lot of guest opinion pieces in the Newsminer and letters to the editor and so forth. And it's he's kind of our author for the Laundry House Gang. Usually, whenever we really need something articulate and well written, we ask Wayne to write it for us. Usually give him about 6 to 10 hours notice before a deadline.
Oh, at least overnight, yeah.
And oftentimes we have to shorten it a little bit. It does sometimes go over the word limit. Yeah. But
usually concise.
Yeah, concise, but very thorough.
I think his experience with the Newsminer is helping with that, though. Yeah. Things are getting shorter because he knows it takes them shorter to get them published.
So we're going to go to the news in about a half a minute. What's going to be on the back half of the agenda? We're going to talk a little bit
about
that.
Well, I think we should talk about the state's argument with the Fed overreach on rights of way and whatnot that started clear back at statehood and is going on. We have some new information that's come up on that. Let's start there.
All right, we'll be back. KFAR Problem Corner.
Coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
It's election day in Georgia and smooth sailing so far in voting for the U.S. Senate runoff there.
Georgia Secretary of State Gabriel Sterling said of the roughly 2,700 voting locations they have, there were lines with a longer than 15-minute wait at 9 of them. As for turnout, more than 1.8 million people cast ballots in early voting last week. As of midday Tuesday, they had about 400,000 ballots cast.
Fox's Jessica Rosenthal. Polls close in Georgia at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. The suspect in the shooting at a Colorado LGBTQ nightclub charged with 305 counts, including first-degree murder and hate crimes.
Our top-end charges are always going to be the murder charges. Those bias-motivated charges do not enhance in any way our top-end sentencing, which is life in prison without parole.
Colorado District Attorney Michael J. Allen, the Club Q shooting, left five people dead. America's listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports that the state is planning to offer a plea deal in the case of a Fairbanks man accused of fatally shooting his half-sister. If the deal is not accepted, the state will pursue a retrial. A Fairbanks jury found Benjamin Kamaroff Akaron, 23, of Fairbanks, not guilty on November 30th on counts of first-degree murder in the 2018 death of Jasmine States and first-degree attempted murder of eyewitness Cody White. However, the jury found Kamaroff Akaron guilty of assault in the third degree, a lesser-included offense, for the first-degree attempted murder charge. The jury deadlocked on a charge of second-degree murder. As a result, Judge Paul Lyle declared a mistrial for the charge. In a status hearing Monday, Prosecutor Catherine Mason said a plea offer is likely forthcoming, and if not accepted by Kamaroff Akaron, the state will proceed with a retrial. And if you're looking to save some money for your holiday shopping, go to AlaskaRadioAuction.com. You can now get another 20% off the already low prices by just entering the code SAVE.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
At Glass Doctor, our trained specialists are experts at fixing foggy and cracked glass, leaving any residential window looking like new without replacing the entire window. Bring back the view of any window with Glass Doctor. Visit GlassDoctor.com to request a free estimate on repairing your foggy or cracked windows. Let Glass Doctor bring back your view.
Call the Glass Doctor, we'll fix your paint. Oh, yeah.
The Find Out Free Pregnancy Center provides free, confidential pregnancy tests to any woman in need. But they offer so much more to women, men, and families. By participating in one-on-one parenting classes selected by you, you can take advantage of Earn While You Learn, earning valuable credit to spend on children's items and clothing in Maria's Boutique. The Find Out Free Pregnancy Center. Call 907-455-8255 or visit online findoutfree.com. Findoutfree.com.
When times are good, you should advertise your business. When times are tough, you must advertise your business. And when it comes to getting the word out, nothing works better than local radio. It reaches more people on a daily basis than TV, newspapers, and even social media combined. And it's way more affordable than you think. So if you are not using local radio to get your word out and keep your business top of mind, you're missing out. But we can help. We are Last Frontier Media Active, the radio station, your local family of radio stations.
When friends and family gather, it's time to lift each other up with delicious food and beverage from Tommy G's Meat and Sausage. All their beef is certified Angus beef, making it truly the best of the best. They pride themselves on superior quality, service, and consistency. Whether it's their cowboy cut ribeyes, lamb shanks, or even their ground chuck, you know you're getting the very best in Alaska because there is no other place like this in Alaska. Stop by Tommy G's Meat and Sausage today, 3290 Pegger Road. It's no longer dinner with friends and family. It's an experience.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM. And streaming live at KFARradio.com.
.com. This is Craig with the Problem Corner. I got to remember, it's not the Compo Outdoor Show. It is Problem Corner with the Laundry House Gang. We do this usually the first Tuesday of every month. Welcome to take your calls. If you have any calls, you have any questions at all about anything to do with, there's a call right there. Look at that. Let's see who this is. Whoops. Hi, this is Problem Corner, and your name is?
Craig, this is Shano LaRon.
Hey, how are you doing?
Not bad. I couldn't resist a comment on one of your earlier topics. I suggest those transgender Canadian bulls are still fair game in as much as cartridges are non-binary.
Yeah, they just taste funny. So.
Take care, guys.
All right. Thanks for the call.
I think we forgot that question on the survey, but yeah, we'll pick that up.
No, it's in the harvest data. There's a small percentage of caribou that's in the harvest data that's unknown.
Unknown.
There you go.
Yeah, good thinking.
Well, you know, we've talked about this. I always do my April 1st fake story on Bill Satterberg in the newspaper because that's his birthday, and kicking around the idea of of doing a bill defending a hunter who shot a cow in a bull-only area because he insisted it identified as a bull, as a bull. So we'll see how that goes. But something I wouldn't put past him. All right, so Mike, let's talk a little about the state, Governor Dunleavy's Statehood Defense Fund and the lawsuit against Deb Haaland.
Yeah, going back a million years, when Jack Coghill was Lieutenant Governor, he started an effort to catalog all of the historic trails that were used for access year-round, they didn't each have to be used year-round. Some of them were winter trails, some were summer trails, some were over water, some, paralleled what we now have as highways and that kind of thing. But there was an effort done then. There were some criteria to list those trails. They were listed under the rural statute, RS-2477. They were cataloged into a book, and each trail had to be able to be found on a map, and it had to have a record of use. And the record of use could be maintenance. For example, the Bureau of Roads that was here before statehood spent a lot of money maintaining these trails. They started building things like the Steese.
Mapping them.
And building things like the Steese Highway where they'd actually have crews out working on them. So there were these records. So the records were compiled into a companion to the map area. And those were basically put there to save, because the federal government, even at that time, was starting to poo-poo the fact that they were really there. They actually got into later, at the request of some of the federal agencies, the USGS took those trails off the maps. So that if you went down and bought a map that showed the area that you were interested in, it would not have historic trails on it. A lot of them don't today. And so that was under the caretaking of the Department of Transportation at first, although it was the Department of Highways in those days. It wasn't transportation until later. And then it was given over to the Division of Lands to manage at DNR. And that comes to modern day times when we come through ANILCA and dividing up large areas of Alaska into units of there are some in the National Park Service, some of these are preserves, some are wildlife refuges, et cetera. But they all had historic trails through them, and the state had identified the rights of way for those trails. Your question?
Yeah, on a 2477, I mean, it's a historical trail. It could be, is there any physical requirements for a 2477? In other words, if somebody in 1892 had a trapping trail that went from, oh, I don't know, Minto to
McGrath.
No, just a one-time made a trapping trail, cut some brush, you know, just enough to get, whether he was walking or whatever, back in, that's what he would, horseback or whatever. Are there requirements for a 2477?
The main requirement was that it be a publicly used route.
If a second trapper used it?
Well, no, I don't think that would qualify, but what it was if you had, for example, back in the early turn of the century, there were a lot of mining places. Almost all of the rivers had some little, today you still see some on the upper good pasture, sure, and Salsha and places where they mined. And those would have a trail, actually usually two trails. You usually have a winter trail that would follow the drainage to get you down out of the hills, maybe back to a trail into Fairbanks. And then in the summertime, it would be up on the ridges somewhere, or somewhere where you wouldn't drown, trying to drag through the swamp to get in. And those, if they were publicly used and if they had a record, they were cataloged. Come to modern times, the state has tried to establish some of those rights of way that are quietly disappearing in the federal regime. The federal government agencies fight that, the National Park Service, a lot of them, BLM even. And even up to the point where some of our modern placer miners that are out there right today are still having arguments with BLM mainly about whether or not they can use the old trail to go into their claims. And so So what the state has been doing, let me bring this around. What the state has been doing then has been recording the data on those trails and then having to sue the federal government for quiet title.
One trail at a time. That's the problem.
Yeah, and it takes several years to get one. There's been a couple lately that have come that way. The Coutina Lake Road was one. There was one with a different background in Anchorage not too long ago. But the state has won on almost all of these. And the other issue is that the federal government knows well what the state's resources are, and theirs are unlimited. So they play this game of running them right to the courthouse steps and then backing out and saying, no, you can have quiet title.
Yeah.
So the state, and at the urging of the Laundryhouse Gang and others over the last decade or so, has said, we've got to quit fooling around one trail at a time because our great-great-grandchildren won't get through it.
Yeah.
And we need you to take this on a systematic basis. And I'm delighted to say that on December 2nd, the state filed for a whole system over in the
Charlie
40,
River.
Over in the 40 mile, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the first one of those to go, and we'll see how that goes.
And there are 10 trails that there, I think there's 10.
And lots of miles.
Lots of miles of trails that are all going to fall into one bucket for this lawsuit against the Interior Department, which I think is, you know, kudos to the governor and finally getting this done. It's no different than the fight with the navigability on the rivers. You know, his plan is to do units, drainages, instead of a river at a time. It takes, what, $6 million in 60 years, I think, or something like that to prove navigability on a river as big as the Kantishna, for gosh sakes. I mean, something like that.
Yeah.
So, you
have to remember, they're not doing this because of a statistic or a natural phenomenon. They're doing it politically.
Yeah.
Okay. And they don't want the state to have this. But there's a logical sense in it too. In that, with navigability, if you recall the last time we talked with DNR about this, right now the navigable waters belonging to the state of Alaska are part of native land selections, for example.
Yeah.
And part of state selections where you were limited in your acres that you could have, or square miles, or whatever it was, and they included the navigability. So if the state breaks those out and says to an individual even who has an allotment, no, you don't have to count that lake or the river part of your allotment because it belongs to the state of Alaska, you should be then able to select
more land,
some additional federal ground next to that. And I hope that comes to fruition.
Well, we're a little schizophrenic on this issue. Through the Sturgeon cases, we know that the navigable waters are property of the state of Alaska. A couple legislatures ago, the state legislature said that navigability includes anything you can travel on, which includes frozen water. Well, we're still kind of hung up on the idea that you have to run an aircraft carrier down a stream for it to be navigable on the federal side, but in our side, it's not. Yeah. You can go there.
Well, they use a certain craft and a certain weight and all that kind of thing. But, however, when Alaska came into the Union, we were brought in on what's called equal footing, which means they are really not supposed to use different determinations for navigability here as they did in someplace like Maine. And you need to break for a minute and we can come back.
Yeah, I want to come back to this. This is fascinating stuff, really, this whole subject matter. But we do have to pay some bills, so we'll be right back. This is Problem Corner in Fairbanks, 907-458-8255.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Make the Christmas dreams of the outdoor lover on your list come true with help from the Outdoor Store. Frontier Outfitters. Fish, hunt, camp, and hike with Alaska-proven clothing and equipment. Guns, camping gear, GPS, and more. You'll find the perfect gift in one easy stop. When you give a Frontier Outfitters gift card, it can be used in Sentry Hardware and the Woolly Rhino as well. Gift wrapping is free. Your holiday shopping just got easier. Frontier Outfitters, for your Alaskan lifestyle.
stay informed of what's happening on the firearm scene today. Tune in to Shooter's Corner with your host, Laura Berkowitz, for news and conversation on guns, your Second Amendment rights, local events, and important legislation. Sponsored in part by Rogers Auto Repair. Rogers Auto Repair has been helping interior Alaskans care for their cars and trucks for nearly 50 years. From the same location near the airport on Dale Road, listen in to Shooter's Corner every Thursday morning at 11, right here on KFAR Radio.
Weather This Hour brought to you by Long Building Technologies. Make your building the smartest around. Call Long today to find out about their building intelligence systems that will save you money. 561-3044. Or find out more at long.com.
KFAR Weather.
A winter weather advisory begins at 1 a.m. early tomorrow morning and continues until 9 p.m. Thursday night. Cloudy today with a chance of snow. High of 19. Winds out of the northeast around 5 miles an hour. Snow likely tonight, 9 above, overcast. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Derek Height.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM. And streaming live at KFARradio.com.
All right, Fairbanks, this is Greg Campo sitting on the other side of the desk from my cohorts, the Laundry House Gang, doing my best Dave Prue's impression here.
Mike, now you have too much hair.
Yeah.
But he does like the Cowboys, don't you?
I just do not. Do not.
Hey.
Well, that's not a good impression of Dave.
His third-string quarterback came through on Sunday.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully we'll come through this next Sunday.
Going back to the Sturgeon case, because I think of our listeners are more familiar with that than some of these historic things. And John won big at the U.S. Supreme Court.
And as
Wayne said, really took a lot of questions out of the navigability issue and what you can do on a navigable river. However, the National Park Service has still not changed any of the regulations about there. So if you went out there tomorrow and you looked at the regulation package of what you could do, it would limit you just like it did then. And that, is to me, is just absurd. That's the political process at its absolute worst.
Yeah, it is. And I talked to my buddy Doug down in Nikiski. They've kind of backed off, but they're not changing their policy. They're just they're not in your face as much anymore. I think they kind of got a wake up call down there, but in that area across the inlet from Kenai. The Yukon, I don't know if they're stopped doing safety checks anymore. I haven't heard of any. So, I mean, but if that's all we want, that's nothing. You know, they need to really, like Mike Wayne says, have a paradigm shift in their attitude, which we're not going to sit and watch and wait for, because that isn't how they're wired.
Well, the governor has said that when he makes the establishment of these things like the navigable waters, and he makes his definition for the state, and it is acceptable for our entire administrative block and whatnot, that the state will basically be the fallback. So if you go out there and you get hassled by somebody because they say, well, you can't use that kind of rowboat on this kind of pond, the state of Alaska will be in your corner to help you out. And that will make a huge difference for somebody like John Sturgeon that ended up going to the U.S. Supreme Court twice. And we all here sitting here know what that kind of energy that took and how much money it took. And so hopefully we get into a situation where we do these things as a team rather than individually and one person at a time.
It should preclude the sort of railroad job that Jim Wild got.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it should. Yeah, Jim was a special character, and he had a heck of a case. And Sturgeon's case, I think, was stronger, and obviously that was a huge win. And I think part of why the governor was so overwhelmingly reelected was people heard about some of these fights for sovereignty, for the navigability fight, these kinds of things. So while they may not have known all the details, anybody that hunts, fishes, hikes, accesses, wants to get out and see the country, I think they really, really respected the governor for his position on a lot of this stuff. Now, going forward, we got to keep the pressure on, right? And so if you run into the governor and administration, make sure you let them know you're really happy with the direction, like with this lawsuit and the navigability issue. But keep the pressure, keep your foot on the throttle, governor. We've got to get this. You got 4 years, and we got to get as much done as we can here. Al?
Yes, sir.
What's, what, What do you think? I was going to ask you earlier about your trapping trail, your main trapping trail.
Is that we're just getting going. But, you know, for a Board of Game update, we did have two meetings in the last couple months.
Okay.
One, we spent about 2 hours on a teleconference having the department give us an update on the sheep status around the state with some history and some details. And it was a really good informational meeting. Learned a little bit. Knew some of the stuff that was already going to take place, and they gave a lot of new board members, you know, some more perspective on how we manage sheep and who causes declines or may not cause declines. So that was a very informational meeting. And then just this last month, we had an agenda change request meeting where there was several topics people wanted to add to the agenda at one of the two meetings this year. We only accepted a couple of them. We did have one board member propose a board-generated proposal to close sheep hunting in 19C altogether for 5 years, I believe.
Tell people where 19C is.
That's just south of McGrath in Unit 19C, and that was passed by 6-1 vote, and so we're going to hear a proposal from the board on should we not or should we close sheep hunting in 19C. Through the biology and all the expertise that we heard the month before, you know, they said hunting is not the reason of decline in any of the sheep populations. In fact, they went to the point of where there are sheep in the state that are non-hunted populations like our national parks and such. The sheep are at the same rate of decline as the very hunted ones, the very high-pressured hunted areas. They're the same rate, and you know, with some history, they've showed the same thing. The rate of increase was the same in a non-hunted population versus a hunted population.
Meaning the decline could be due more to weather, disease, other factors.
Yes, it was. You know, it's environment, predation, and habitat.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's almost too bad. I was thinking if Wayne's book would have been available before that meeting, anybody with a chair that was offset, they could have slid that book under that one chair leg and put that book to good use. You know, well, I still always...
It's only about, three-eighths of an inch thick is all here, Greg.
I thought I made a good mouse pad.
Yeah.
I still like, for the listeners out there, you can ask your friends, if you ever get a chance, what percentage of the moose and caribou population do you think are harvested by man? Bill Hager was the one that made that chart originally. And I remember I was just getting into this, and I saw that, and I said, I can't be right. That just sounds too low. And it was like 4-5%
of all the caribou. Even less than some populations,
Yeah. So, you know, you ask the average novice person that's on the street, they're probably going to go, I don't know, 30 or 40% or 50%.
All?
Yeah. Or any Democrat would say 80%. But, 4-5% of the moose and caribou population are harvested by man.
Yeah.
The rest are taken by animals, natural causes, weather.
What Al brought up is a kind of hobby horse of mine, and that's board-generated proposals. I've been thinking about this for quite a while.
Can I hiss and boo first?
Well, you feel free. It's just an idea. But the reason we have the Board of Game is to protect Alaskans from overreach by the federal government in territorial times where arbitrary rules were made. You know, when we have a Board of Game, the manager is the commissioner of Fish and Game, not the Board of Game. But when we have a Board of Game that thinks up a crisis, thinks up a proposal, then passes it, ignoring perhaps the advisory committees, which are supposed to help, and public testimony, that's exactly what we're trying to get away from at statehood.
Yeah.
And I'm really troubled with the idea, I'm just annoyed with the idea that you have a body of people that can think up a problem, think up their solution, and solve it without really involving the manager.
Al, what do you think about the idea of, in order to put a proposal in, you should have to have sat in on a RAC or the AC committee or something where you've got, how much are frivolous time wasters of the 130 proposals or whatever that are out there? How much more could you get done if 75 of those or whatever number that just don't have a chance or just aren't well thought out? I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's the process that we have, and you shouldn't. You know, if people don't get involved at a local level, they may have less knowledge than others, but then there's people that just tend to not meet at meetings, and they're very smart people individually. So, you know, I never want to take that away. But right. over time, and I haven't been around as these other two gentlemen have, but I've been in the board of game business for a long time. About 75%, maybe even higher, the proposals that you see are proposals that have been around for years and years and years and years. And, you know, I've seen it in several examples, and I was doing some research, and, you know, back in 1986, you know, this same subject was at a board of game meeting in southeast Alaska. So there's not really much new, but occasionally there are.
Yeah. Well, it just seems I haven't heard the buffer zone issue for a little while.
Well, it's a history thing, too. There used to be a filter system on it, so that the board got proposals that had been through a step-down process. Mm-hmm. That went away because of budget some years ago, and now the board has to look at all those hundreds of proposals. The way it originally worked, out of hundreds of proposals, they might get a dozen.
Well, they got rid of the council system, is what you're talking about.
No, they got rid of the co-joining of advisory committees right. is what they used to do.
Al, you've been on it. You said, you know, you've been in the board of game business a while. We got a couple, 3 minutes left. If you could wave your magic wand, is there one process that, one thing that would be low-hanging fruit you think that could change that would make the system and the process work better? Is there something that always seems to get in the way? Is there just something that, whether it's a bureaucratic rule or anything, is there anything you can think of that could improve the system that we're not doing?
Boy, I'd have to think about that, but maybe Wayne's got a better one.
Wayne, you got one?
Yeah. You know, the Constitution, you know, Article 8, Sections 1 through 4, pretty much tells you what the policy and the direction of management is. If we were to screen every proposal, somebody, I don't know who has to do this. I'm kind of busy writing books, but if somebody were to screen those and say, you know, does this meet criteria? And there are about three of them in the Constitution. Doesn't meet those criteria, it's out. We're not even going to think about it.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd almost need an independent group of three people or something.
If the manager of the Fish and Wildlife, the commissioner's office, would care to apply those same criteria, that would do it. But that would seem kind of arbitrary.
Yeah, it seems like we appease some groups sometimes, whether it's legitimate or not, just to
Well, what happens is you got the three articles in the Constitution. What they don't speak about is the social issues that people get all wrapped around the wheel with.
Yeah, general well-being.
Yes.
Well, this has been interesting, guys. thanks for joining us. This has been the Laundry House Gang. AKA the Laundry House Gang, meet every Wednesday. Our mission is to keep Alaska Alaskan, and we have a really good group of people. If you ever have any issue that you want to bring by to the group, we're TVSA every Wednesday. You can if you got an issue or you've got a situation that you think has to do with the fish and game or access issues, we're all ears. We like to listen. We try to help. In those cases where we feel somebody's been taken advantage of by the state or especially the feds, so feel free to join us.
And AC meetings on first or second Wednesday of every month.
Second
Wednesday of every month.
Yep. And join us here on the first Tuesday of every month for the Laundry House Gang. My name is Craig Campo with Wayne Heimer, Mike Tinker, and Al Barrett. Thank you guys for joining us. We look forward to seeing you next week. I don't know when Pruz is back. Whenever he gets back.
No, that mayor training takes a long time.
Yeah, it's going to take him twice as long. All right, Fairbanks, thanks for joining us. We will see you a month from today. Take care.